Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The U.S. Senate's latest Obamacare repeal and replace campaign is already in trouble, and a health policy analyst says that's especially good news for Florida.
So the real loss to Florida from this legislation, we estimate to be about $9.7 billion in the period from 2020 to 2026.
Also this week, how could repeal of the Affordable Care Act impact those patients who rely on so-called free clinics for their health care?
It was either you eat food or you pay health insurance.
We'll also learn how Hurricane Irma impacted the state's military facilities, how it might affect state water policy, and how it also stirred up a mess of politics in Florida. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. There is, of course, important breaking news of national significance as this edition of Capitol Report goes on the air. The latest attempt by congressional Republicans to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act could be in trouble now that Arizona Senator John McCain has voiced his opposition publicly. Lynn Hatter reports the move comes a day after the Kaiser Family Foundation released an analysis showing Florida's Medicaid program, which supports low-income residents, could lose nearly $10 billion over 6 years if the measure were to gain passage. Lynn spoke with the foundation's policy analyst, Dr. Diane Rowland.
Dr. Rowland, thank you so much for joining me here today. I wanted to ask you a question about this recent study that the Kaiser Family Foundation put out about the Graham-Cassidy bill and the $7.5 billion loss that the state of Florida would sustain in Medicaid funding if this measure were to pass. How did you all come up with that number? What went into this analysis?
What that number represents is a allocation of what is created as the new block grant in the Graham-Cassidy bill. So the Graham-Cassidy bill takes what has been paid to the states on behalf of their Medicaid expansion population and what has been paid out in terms of federal funds for the subsidies for individuals in the marketplace and their cost sharing, and takes all those funds nationally and puts them in a pool. So all the funds that went to expansion states and all the funds that went to every state for the marketplace enrollees from the federal government gets put into a pool and then reallocated out to the states. So what we've done is take that pool and reallocate it using the formula that the Graham-Cassidy bill specifies out to the states and compared it to what the states would previously have gotten in the case of Florida for subsidies and cost sharing for the people in the marketplace since Florida didn't expand Medicaid. And there we see that Florida over that period would get $7.6 billion less from the block grant. And then we've also estimated for Florida what the additional financial hit would be from the per capita cap being imposed on the overall traditional Medicaid program. That's another $2 billion. So the real loss to Florida from this legislation, we estimate to be about $9.7 billion in the period from 2020 to 2026.
Now, this bill would also allow states a lot more leeway in what they cover under Medicaid. Talk a little bit about that, if you could.
Well, the reality is that where the states gain flexibility under the Graham-Cassidy bill is in the use of those block grant funds, where Florida is losing out as opposed to gaining. In the Medicaid program itself, Graham-Cassidy caps the spending under that, so it puts tighter limits in, and we estimate that Florida will lose $2 billion in Medicaid funding in addition to the losses through the block grant. and does not give states a lot of new flexibility under Medicaid, although we anticipate, as does everyone, that the administration will be very favorable to continued Medicaid waivers. So I'd say that for the Medicaid program itself, there's not a lot of new flexibility unless for traditional Medicaid, unless states go in and get additional waivers from the administration, but the legislation doesn't provide them new flexibility. In fact, in some ways, the legislation takes away flexibility from the states for their Medicaid program, since it essentially prohibits them from covering adults without dependent children at any point in their Medicaid programs.
What are some of the options that states have exercised in the past to trim down spending on Medicaid? And what are some of the things that they, you know, might likely do?
Well, certainly we see in both Florida and in all of the states that we're talking to, they're doing a great deal right now around trying to reorganize their delivery systems to try and get efficiencies from the way in which care is delivered. Virtually all states have gone to some form of managed care for the children and adults in their program, and increasingly are trying to see how to use that mechanism to better provide coordinated care and services for some of the high-need disability and elderly populations that they also serve. So we're really seeing a focus in many states on how to get the high-need populations, especially those who need long-term services and supports, better served in the community, better coordinated in terms of their care so that they can be better managed and have less hospitalizations and less costly care and still better quality and better outcomes. So I think that's been one big focus. We've also seen states really working on trying to figure out how to do payment systems for their providers better, whether it's through managed care or whether it's doing more value-based purchasing. So states are really trying to get the handle on providing care to these high-cost, very often sick, chronically ill patients that make up the bulk of Medicaid expenditures. It's not the moms and kids that cost states money. It's the elderly and people with disabilities. But healthcare, as we know, nationally is an expensive proposition, and so there's only so much states can do to control the cost. What we really need to do is to work collectively across all payers to reduce the cost of healthcare, not just the cost for Medicaid.
Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter speaking with Dr. Diane Rowland, health policy analyst from the Kaiser Family Foundation. There's another healthcare issue to discuss because of that drive in the U.S. Senate to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. What about patients for whom even coverage through the Affordable Care Act is still unaffordable? Many Floridians have jobs but still don't have enough money to pay for health insurance, and they often wind up with only one option for primary care: the state's free and charitable clinics. Health News Florida editor Julio Ochoa talked with some of those patients.
A mild stroke sent St. Petersburg resident Lori No to St. Anthony's Hospital in May. She was feeling a pain in her leg but didn't think much of it.
And I walked in Sam's Club, my whole side of my face went numb. So I went home, called my mommy, and she said, get to the hospital.
No, who was in her 50s, didn't have insurance, but she knew about the St. Petersburg Free Clinic. That's where she headed after the hospital. During a visit last month, No sat in an exam room at the clinic, which looks like a typical doctor's office.
It was mostly your face that was numb. Was that a Bell palsy or was that a stroke?
They said it was a stroke.
Dr. Frederick Guerrier scans her chart.
EKG was normal. Your hemoglobin, you smoke?
Yeah. I've almost quit, though. We're down maybe 4 or 5 cigarettes a day.
This sounds like any other doctor-patient exchange, but there's one difference. Dr. Guerrier is a volunteer. He's one of several who work for free to keep the clinic operating on a budget of less than $900,000 a year. There are more than 100 free clinics like this in Florida. For some patients, like No, the clinics are their only option. Dr. Ajoy Kumar is the St. Petersburg Clinic's medical director.
Everybody that comes through here, we're basically a way station. You know, if you can get someplace, get the job, get the insurance, you know, take care of your health, good for you. You know, that's all we want.
No says she signed up for the Affordable Care Act years ago, but had to drop it after she lost her job and couldn't afford to pay the premiums.
It was either you eat food or you pay health insurance. You know, and it's like, what is it going to be? I had three kids and a husband. We're going to eat.
The charitable clinics don't turn people away, but patients have to meet requirements to get regular care. First, they must be between 18 and 65 years old and have no health insurance. Many clinics also require patients to prove how much money they make. Those who make too little are usually eligible for county-level health insurance. Steve Peters found a free clinic in Brandon called The Outreach when he was going through a rough patch. Peters lost his health insurance when his flower business started going under about 8 years ago.
My business started going bad. I had to drop myself from the insurance. I was paying my employees, but I couldn't do it.
He sunk every penny he had into paying off the business's debts, and then he went through a divorce. Peters had been working 7 days a week for years, and his health was deteriorating. Then a blood clot in his leg landed him in the emergency room last year. He needed regular blood checks, but couldn't afford them.
I ended up back in the hospital sick, really sicker this time, and close to death.
A woman from the outreach clinic visited Peters in the hospital. She told him it didn't matter if he had no money. The clinic would take care of him.
And they helped me. And thank God they helped me. So like I said, I owe my debt of gratitude to this place.
He's much better now and working again. Next year, he'll turn 65. Medicare will kick in, and he won't need the clinic anymore. Dr. Kumar from the St. Petersburg Clinic says many of the patients he treats have similar stories.
You will see this is real America here. Right. Okay, this is what people that aren't lawmakers or people that are really wealthy always say. Those two types of folks right there, they can get access to a physician all the time. It's the rest of America that isn't a lawmaker, isn't fabulously wealthy, or even wealthy, have struggles.
And that's what motivates Kumar and others to keep these clinics going. For Health News Florida, I'm Julio Ochoa in Tampa.
Still to come on Capitol Report, while nursing home representatives are expressing doubts they'll meet a deadline to get generators installed, state leaders say something needs to get done.
I don't know if it's impractical or not, but we have to address the issue that we have in the state of Florida right now.
Hurricane Irma may be gone, but it left a host of political issues, as well as nursing home fatalities, flooding, downed trees, and power outages in its wake.
That's what happens when you have strong leadership in times of natural disasters. It always escalates an executive's rating, if done right.
And certainly the storm did plenty of damage to civilian facilities, but what about the impact on Florida's multitude of military installations? Following the death of 10 seniors living in a Hollywood nursing facility, officials have put an emergency rule in place requiring nursing homes and assisted living facilities to install generators that will keep the facilities cool for at least 96 hours in the event of power loss. But the rule also requires they get it done within 60 days. Regan McCarthy reports while facility operators are generally supportive of the move, they caution they're not likely to make the deadline.
Pacifica Senior Living Woodmont is one of Tallahassee's oldest assisted living facilities. When it was built, Director Scott Dalton says generators for air conditioning weren't at the top of most people's minds. But recently, he's been working to get one installed.
We have been working on this issue for about a year and just going through all the steps that need to be taken to install a permanent generator. It's going to take more than 60 days.
That was the same general sentiment shared by a panel of experts speaking at a nursing center emergency preparedness summit.
Show of hands, how many thought you went to Home Depot and bought them and plugged them in?
That's panel moderator Debbie Franklin. John Wiseman, a panel member representing Core Construction, says there's a lot more to it than that.
Permitting the different entities involved. First and foremost, you have ACCA, which Skip spoke to very well. I talked to our local building official. And these are the different departments, building, zoning, fire department, air and water. Bill spoke to the planning commission possibly if you got a loss of parking. Again, this is going to take up two or three parking spaces if you have no place else to put it. And then the county commission if you're going to have to violate setback requirements.
Wiseman says each of those permitting offices will create a bottleneck, slowing the process down as officials work to process a new flood of permits before the deadline. Experts say more bottlenecks will be created by manufacturers, equipment, supplies, and workers needed to install the generators. Hialeah Republican Senator Rene Garcia is the chair of the Children, Family, and Elder Affairs Committee. He admits the time frame is, in his words, aggressive, but he says something has to happen, and soon.
I don't know if it's impractical or not, but we have to address the issue that we have in the state of Florida right now. I've always said that government needs to be the voice for the voiceless, and these individuals at the time of that nursing home were voiceless, and we need to make sure that they have the right resources and adequate protections to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Meanwhile, Justin Sr., the head of the Agency for Healthcare Administration, or ACA, says he's determined to see the generators installed, and installed the right way.
We're going to implement the emergency rule. We're going to try to bring every single facility in this state into compliance with the emergency rule in the coming months, and we're going to work with the legislature on getting this rule codified in the upcoming legislative session.
Senior says he realizes rushing work could create dangerous circumstances in which generators are not properly installed and pose the danger of carbon monoxide poisoning. But he says the danger of doing nothing is even greater. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
From Governor Rick Scott to legislative leaders, Hurricane Irma is forcing Florida's top elected officials to wade into the politics of disaster. As Jim Ash reports, it can be risky territory.
Governor Rick Scott looked weary but confident. Beside him at the State Emergency Operations Center stood grim-faced National Guard officers and some deadly serious aides. Hurricane Irma had just pounded the Florida Keys and was churning up the peninsula like a cosmic rolling pin.
We're proud to call Florida home, and nothing will change that. While I know we have done everything we could to prepare for this storm, we can never do enough. I've heard from other governors and from people all over the world about the ways they can help our state make it through this destruction.
Historians will measure Scott's crisis leadership in the number of lives saved and the rise and fall of the GDP. But as University of South Florida political scientist Susan McManus reminds us, voters will measure it at the polls. Scott is eyeing a U.S. Senate seat, and McManus says his Irma performance should be a plus.
That's what happens when you have strong leadership in times of natural disasters. It always escalates an executive's ratings, if done right.
History supports her argument. Former Governor Jeb Bush's approval ratings were a dismal 41% before a string of hurricanes struck in 2004 and 2005. They soared to 62% after. But disaster politics can also be a minefield. A constant risk, McManus says, is appearing aloof, as another Bush knows all too well.
On the other hand, they can crater like a George W. Bush appearing insensitive to Katrina, but I think that Katrina taught local and state officials the need to be in the middle of it, caring with your sleeves rolled up.
Politicians also have to be careful not to look like they're cashing in on tragedy, McManus says. President Donald Trump appeared to come close during a post-Irma visit with Scott to Southwest Florida.
But I know that at a certain point, it ends for you, and we can't let it end. So I hope he runs for Senate. Who knows what he's going to do?
Of course, Democrats aren't immune. U.S. Senator Bill Nelson, the man Scott wants to unseat, is raising questions about 10 heat-related deaths at a Hollywood Hills nursing home. On the Senate floor, Nelson alluded to news stories that suggest Scott mishandled calls for help from the Broward facility. Scott has hotly denied the accusations, and investigations are underway.
All the phone calls that had been made that were not answered, both to the government as well as to the power company, as reported by the press.
Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, who was running for governor, briefly suspended his campaign and converted a political fundraiser to disaster relief. Now Gillum's back on the trail and hammering Republican leadership about the nursing home tragedy.
We ought to ask the right questions and begin to make the right changes to make sure that the kind of fatalities that we experience, the kind of delay in power restoration that we experience, all, you know, priority issues that get addressed.
Senator Jack Latvala, a Republican from Clearwater who was also running for governor, beat a unique path to the Irma spotlight. Latvala demanded the power companies stop giving political contributions and invest the money instead in hardening the grid.
I just think that the kind of money that they spend in political campaigns and on political purposes leads to a perception or a reality of their control over the political process in Tallahassee.
Irma's biggest political impact comes in January when the legislature convenes, McManus says.
I expect you're going to see quite a bit of regional competition for funding. And of course, in an election year, on top of it, it enhances representing the local needs.
House Speaker Richard Corcoran has formed a select committee to study everything from gasoline reserves to burying power lines. But Corcoran is a lame duck and also eyeing higher office. And that, McManus says, will make it much harder to keep his chamber in line. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Hurricane Irma hung over an annual gathering of state and industry officials discussing water policy. We get that story from Nick Evans.
Associated Industries of Florida holds a water forum every year, bringing out lawmakers, regulators, and local officials. In addition to giving industry representatives a chance to rub elbows with policymakers, the meeting typically looks ahead to plans for the coming year. But Hurricane Irma had many looking backward.
That rainfall, district-wide, 10.24 inches of rain.
That's Ann Shortell, out of the St. John's Water Management District. She says that rainfall translates to 2.2 trillion gallons, or enough to cover consumption in her district for 5 years.
Where is that water? Well, billions and billions of gallons have gone out the mouth of the St. John's, shunted over to the Indian River Lagoon and the like. This is that management tension, and this is why the storage component and the reuse component are so critically important.
Florida's population is growing, and ensuring there's enough potable water to go around becomes more difficult with each new arrival. It means Shortell and other officials are looking for ways to conserve, store, and reuse water. Department of Environmental Protection Deputy Secretary Drew Bartlett says it's part of why the agency wants money for the land buying program Florida Forever.
We're also asking for $50 million in Florida Forever. When you think about the mix of where we live and our natural lands, that mix needs to be there. And it was honestly highlighted by Irma, because where do we put, you know, where does the water go when we get it out of our households? It goes to our natural systems.
But the program has struggled for funding since the Great Recession, and the $50 million mark is about a sixth of what lawmakers used to budget for it. Despite a guaranteed funding source in Amendment 1 dollars, lawmakers refused to appropriate money to Florida Forever earlier this year. Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley says repairing infrastructure damaged in the storm will only make funding water projects more difficult. He points to a bridge closure in his district.
That hurts our economy. The people expect it to be addressed because they're used to driving on it every day. And that is now going to be needed to be addressed, and that is millions of dollars. And so that is now millions of dollars that you can't spend on something that you would want to otherwise. And that is going to be happening throughout the state of Florida.
Earlier this month, state economists warned lawmakers money will be tight. Projections put the total of new money at about $52 million, and that's before factoring in storm-related costs. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Hurricane Irma forced hundreds of thousands of Floridians from their homes, including residents at military bases. Key West and Jacksonville saw some of the worst effects of the storm, and they're also home to major military installations. But Kate Payne reports the bases are returning to normal.
Thousands of service members from across the country flocked to Florida to help recover from Irma, but some of the state's own forces were in need of support. The Florida Keys saw some of the worst damage. Apart from being home to world-famous beaches, the island chain also supports Naval Air Station Key West.
NAS sustained, what the commander said, minimal damage.
Republican Holly Rothschein represents the Keys in the Florida House.
Our famous Fly Navy building lost its roof. So it'll be a little while before that comes back.
Before the storm shifted to the east, the outlook was dire for low-lying Tampa Bay as well, and its Air Force Base. General Chip Deal served as a deputy director there.
MacDill Air Force Base evacuated the whole base because we are 6 feet above sea level. We're on the end of that peninsula, and they did actually evacuate.
Tampa ultimately dodged the worst of the storm, despite its vulnerable and heavily developed flood zones. And in Jacksonville, home of Navy, Coast Guard, and Marine Corps contingents?
Here in Jacksonville, we had significant flooding.
Admiral Mark Fitzgerald represents the Navy on Florida's Defense Support Task Force.
A lot of trees down. In front of my house looks like a war zone out there with all of the rubbish and debris.
But Fitzgerald says the installations didn't see the catastrophic flooding that other parts of the city did.
The base has suffered no major damage. There's obviously minor damage from the flooding. It all seems to be going okay. People are back to work, planes are flying, etc.
One reason there wasn't more damage is because of storm protocols. The bases didn't just evacuate people.
The ships sortied. They departed the area to go where it was safe. Aircraft flew to other bases inland to where it was safe.
Bill Doherty is a spokesman for Navy Region Southeast. He says the state's bases are now more or less up and running, except for Key West, which is lagging a bit. But as of Friday the 22nd, the station is letting families move back. Holly Rauschein again.
The biggest thing for our commanding officer was waiting to bring back non-essential personnel. He didn't want them coming home without power or sewer or running water, and that has pretty much come back online across all the properties on the base.
But Doherty says the storm was still a major disruption.
Pretty much all the naval aviation training takes place in the southeastern United States. So that mission, you know, was impacted by the storms, both Harvey and Irma.
Each base is looking back on their lessons learned, and Rauschein is drafting her own after-action report.
We're going to be taking a look at the legislative level, where we can make improvements, and I have a list. I've already started a list where we can make some improvements as a state, not only just in the Keys, but statewide.
General Michael Calhoun leads the state's National Guard, and he says the event still isn't over.
We still have guardsmen on state active duty conducting primary logistics and security support, and we'll continue as long as we're needed.
Irma is a reminder of how vulnerable the state and its bases are to natural disasters. But Doherty says the storm won't change the Navy's long-term plans for Florida.
Whether you're in Florida and you're dealing with, you know, hurricanes, or you're in the West Coast and you're dealing with the big wildfires and things like that, okay, every place has its challenges.
Hurricane season runs through the end of November. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.